if you find out anything more or experience it and have a positive or a negative response to it. So I thank you for participating, Kay. Next on our list is Tom, K2HZE. You wanted to talk about compromise antennas for an HOE, I think?
Yeah, net control, how you doing? You got Tom here, K2HZE. I appreciate you picking me up and letting me in. And hello to everyone out there on the net as well. Hopefully everyone's staying safe and everyone's good. Yeah, I have a question. I have a friend of mine. He's in the state of Washington. And he's running, or he's trying to figure out an antenna system to use on a balcony that's covered by three sides, and he's trying to get it to work where he can get out on HF. He ordered what was called the super antenna. I don't know if anyone's ever heard about it. It's a vertical and everything. But we got it to tune on 20. Every other band, it would not tune no matter what he did. So he's trying to think about going with a loop antenna, or another friend of mine recommended a Tar Heel antenna to use on a second-story condo balcony. Now, I'm not very familiar as far as, using loop antennas and stuff, but, not to keep the net long and bother you guys, but maybe you have a couple of suggestions and something we can do, over.
Okay. First, I just want to make sure we're both talking about the same thing. When you say a loop antenna, I believe you're alluding to a magnetic loop, a small loop antenna, because there are one wavelength loop antennas out there, and their dynamics is completely different. So you're talking about a shortened magnetic loop, right?
That is correct. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. I tend to be a fan of magnetic loops. There are downsized things, but there are good things. The problem with magnetic loops is they're very, very shortened. They basically operate sort of like very short dipoles. That are circularly arranged so that they don't need a lot of elevation, so that's a good thing. You don't have to have them climb into the stratosphere. You don't need them on the roof. You can put them, as long as they're more than about 10 feet off the ground, they're usually good. The problem with the shortened loop is, again, a very high Q, which means a very narrow bandwidth, which means every time you change the frequency by a kilohertz, you got to retune the antenna. You can't do it at the antenna tuner site because you'll get too much loss in the transmission line. So you have to tune it in the antenna. The way that magnetic loops work is they have a variable capacitor in the open slot of the larger loop. And you adjust the variable capacitor accordingly, and you tune the loop. You then drive the antenna inductively, usually, with a secondary, much smaller loop that has the feed line going to it. So you have to change the capacitance. Now, there's two things. If you do it manually, it can be a real pain in the backside, because if you don't have something like gear reduction, just by moving that variable capacitor the tiniest bit, you can overshoot the tuned area. So you need, at the very least, a gear reduction vernier type of device, knob, or people use servos, but that adds to the expense. So if you got lots of money, you buy something that someone programmed, it does its own test for the VISWA, it has a servo that adjusts the capacitor, and it tunes itself as you change the frequency. But you got to pay for that. Also, it has a very, very low ability to transmit power because it has a very high Q. The voltage potential between the two plates of the variable capacitor, the volts are very high. So you need, if you're going to drive it with more than, say, 30 watts, you're going to need a real beefy capacitor or a vacuum capacitor, and that adds price. So those are the downs and the ups of magnetic loop, and we'll talk about the other things as well. But do you have any questions about that?
control. No, no, that actually helped me tremendously. I have a couple of people that are listening. I'm actually talking to you on a 991A, and they're actually listening in the background through a remote hand. They're not going to transmit, don't worry. The station I'm trying to help is WJ6FOX. So now, as far as, what if he was to go with something like a Tar Heel or something, someone recommended, being that he's using a Yaesu FT450D, it is the second story of the house, what do you think about something like that, or maybe that's more for a car, you know, if you can answer that, and that'll be it.
Okay, a Tar Heel is basically a screwdriver antenna, and it sort of goes back to part of the discussion that I was having with Wesley, N2XJAX. It's a bottom-loaded, a mechanically shortened monopole, and the screwdriver motor will change the inductive connection where in the coil it shorts out. So it will supply enough additional inductance to electrically lengthen the shortened monopole to a quarter wave. You have a bigger problem with that in that, as I mentioned earlier, you have the more inductance you need to correct the upper whip, the higher the Q, the lower the shorter the bandwidth, and the less efficient the antenna. So depending upon the design, the longer the actual whip, the more efficient it's going to be in most cases. So if you have something, Tar Heels are very well designed, and they make great antennas for mobile sites because they can be rather compact and give you a lot less trouble. I don't think their efficiency is generally on a par with something like a magnetic loop. So again, magnetic loops have positives and other negatives. The Tar Heel, it's easier to put in more watts without worrying about arcing of capacitors and such. So it's doable, but think of it as, at best, a quarter wave a ground plane antenna on a porch. It's going to give you problems with the surroundings as well. So it's doable. Both of them are certainly doable. We talked earlier with Wayne who cross-connected the balans and he got away with it. So both of them will work. Again, I happen to be a fan of the magnetic loops. If you can deal with the problem of keeping them in tune and the problem of limiting your power output.
All right, Net Control, I appreciate it. And just one more question. As far as an HOA situation, is there something you might be able to recommend, and then I'll let you guys continue?
Okay. With HOAs, it sort of depends on how anal retentive these people can be. The usual solution offered everyone is the famous flagpole antenna, in which you're basically hiding some vertical wire inside a fiberglass pole and putting a flag on the top of it. And when the inspectors come by, you just say, what antenna? So that seems to be the go-to HOA. Otherwise, it's more of a matter of either keeping it small and or keeping it portable. I knew a guy that I don't, I'm not quite sure if he's all there. He had a Rhone extendable mast, and the story that he used to tell was that he had the mast collapsed at during the day, and at night when it was dark, he would raise the mast, which is not an easy thing to do because there's no mechanical motor or anything, and he would drop it down before he went to sleep, that night. So all that they would see would be a pole without any kind of obvious antenna. I think that's a little bit too much effort, personally.
Control. I really appreciate everyone. Thank you for the time, and thank you for that. Well, he was listening, so I'm sure he'll know, and we'll make a decision and see what he's going to go with. And I will let you guys know maybe next week and join the net again. So thank you so much from K2H City and WJ6FOX listening in the background.
Okay, very good, Tom. Thanks for participating, and please come back and tell us how your friend is doing with his antennas choices. And, there's so many different types of antenna that people can choose from. It's rather problematic when you have a very, very small volume. That kind of limits you all the way down to loaded coils and magnetic loops and things that are very, very compact. So I wish him luck.
WB2KWC with a comment.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, thank you, Roy. As far as the magnetic loop antennas go, you need to pay attention to both the power and the mode. You can probably run more power, let's say, on SSB than on digital, simply because of the duty cycles. And also something that I'm using, not because of HOA, but rather because of poor property layout and power lines all around, is I've run an MFED half wave right now. I've also run a dipole. I've run that in my attic. So if he's like on the top floor, or if he owns the entire building, he can run something in your attic. It's completely invisible. And when the guys come around looking for, I don't know, the cause of any possible interference, you just stay off the air. All right, well, thank you for that. I really do appreciate it. Well, like I said, he's going to have to make a decision and see what he can do. I believe he does have some sort of access to the attic. But like I said, this has really helped us tremendously, and we appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken, for that added. You can build inside the house as long as you don't have a tin roof to kind of shield you from the RF. We have our own George, KD2FIU, who tinkers in that lofty space as well. And other people who also try that out, and it works. So thank you very much, Ken, for mentioning it, and thanks again, Tom, for participating. So, Wesley, you want to pick up the conversation about the LAB-599 or something similar? Wesley, are you out there?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm back. Okay. So, thank you for letting me talk. So we have a Russian radio that is called LAB-599-TX-500. It's the best in the world radio in terms of efficiency, energy efficiency. It uses liquid crystal, not in color, it's a black and white. It's quite clear. It does have a sort of waterfall. It's not a waterfall, but you could see an entire band and all stations on the band. Let me go. 10 watts up to 15 watts, depends on the band. It doesn't have antenna tuner. However, the company says that they will make antenna tuner when you turn it upside down. You see that this radio has a contact ready to be used with additional antenna tuner that would be actually sandwiching the original radio. The radio is extremely, extremely thin, so it's about 1 inch, 1.5 inch at max in thick, and it's about 7 to 4 inches long and 4 inches wide. But I'm giving you that dense information from my head. I don't have the spec on it. It does have 6 meters too. As I say, it's a Russian radio, a small manufacturing. The PCB is like the Chinese. And so far, there are very good opinion about it. It is not available. We have to find out if Russian would be able to make it till September, and also the servicing will be done in America through the seller. The next one is MFJ Xiegu. It's the model number is X5105 QRP ham radio. Good radio, 5 watts, also 160 to 6 meters, but it does have an antenna tuner. And I wasn't able to find out the ASU QRP radio that is right now on sale, but the price is about $700. So if you, Dr. Roy, have the model number of that ASU radio, I would appreciate it. Enter it.
What's this model number of the ZAZU? Wesley, do you have the model number? I see two MFJ, three actually. They don't go anywhere near $800. The most expensive is designated XP8125B, and the other one is an XG90.
X5105, are you talking about Xiegu, MFJ, Xiegu?
Yeah, I was talking about Xiegu, but I can't find it on MFJ's website. The most expensive model they have is listed supposedly for $549.95, and the real selling point is $459.95. That's the XPA-125B.
About HFQRP. So we're talking about X5105.
Okay, I can't find it on MFJ's own page.
Okay. A few words about a very much known brand, Electraft. Good radios. I would love if you say a few words about it, Dr. Roy. We have KX2 and KX3. There was KX1 before. Now we have a KX2, and KX2 is mostly CW radio. It's a very small one, great receiver, absolutely amazing. The only difference between KX2 and KX3 is that KX3 has full ability for digital and SSB, as the KX2 is digital and a telegraphy Yeah, that would be that, right. Digital and F1 modulation. Hold on. Yeah. So, you can do analog telegraphy on it, and you can do digital. But both of them are the modern electronics devices, very light. When you compare it to the Russian can live on its battery probably about four times longer than Electraft. Electraft use a backlighted display for it. And well, we can say about all the QRP and modern transceivers, they are somewhere between 2 watts and 10 watts at max, but most of them have only 5 watts. If you recall the 8-year-old ESU 817, that was 818, the next one, but 817 was very much popular. It was big body, small display, but had everything, including HF and 2 meters and 70 centimeters. And do it here.
Yeah, Wesley, the Elecrafts are beautiful equipment, both the big table models and these very small QRPs. The KX2... they all do AM, FM, single sideband, digital, as far as I'm aware. The differences in the details, the KX3 is a little bit more expensive. It goes, instead of the KX2 goes from 80 to 10 meters, the KX3 goes from 160 to 6 meters. But I think they both handle QRP power, AM, FM, and single sideband, CW, and data. Very well made, premium priced, very light, very nice models. Technologically, they're a little on the old side these days. You know, technology moves on. I think they were kind of the model that ICOM looked at when they made up the specs for their IC705 SDR. That also is a QRP portable radio. It's not quite all the bells and whistles of the KX3. It's a lovely. The company is an American manufacturer. They manufacture and sell from the United States, so that's also a factor if people are interested in. They make very, very fine radios.
ICOM 705, and they have also AH705, that is a compact antenna tuner that goes on the back. It's sandwiched on the back of the radio, and it's a really, really great stuff. I don't know if you had a chance to touch it.
No, I have spoken to people who own them. I have seen YouTubes of people playing with them. I have read endless very good reviews of them. The only little problem I see with them is that by nature they are QRP devices. I would assume that at some point, if they continue to be as popular as I think they are, ICOM and other third parties will introduce efficient linear amplifiers that, in the same way that their antenna tuner kind of locks into position, that will lock into position. So as a base station, it'll give people something like 100 watts, which most people are really looking for in a base station radio. But it's a beautiful radio, and I love software-defined radio technology, and the 705 is definitely an SDR radio.
Right, that the 705 has RJ45 to connect to the internet?
I believe it does have a RJ45 connector. I could be wrong, but I think it does. It certainly, it's a very, very state-of-the-art type of a design. So there's software that ICOM sells that interfaces with it, that you could remote control it on a computer and such.
Do you use?
Well, right now I'm using my old favorite ICOM 7100. It's a shack in the box. It doesn't have any bells and whistles. It's sort of very reminiscent to the monochrome display of the Russian radio. It's about 10 years old. It came out around when I got my license. Very nice, very small, very compact, and hasn't given me a lick of trouble. And it has a lot of very nice features that I use. It allows me to stream both my transmission signal and my received signal, so I can record it for Mike's archives when he's not able to record the TechNet. And I can stream it to the four people who are listening right now on the audio stream. So. And I can record it to an SD card in case my computer blows up. I'll have a record to save it to. So I like my ICOM 7100. And for all the bells and whistles, I also have a Flex Radio 6700. It's a software-defined radio. It has two hardware receivers. It's capable of simulating each four different receivers. So I could watch eight different pan adapters of pretty much everything going on HF when I do my little 10-meter net control operator thing. I could take a look at the entire HF spectrum and get a vague idea of how the rest of the bands are doing. So I love to play with the 6700. That's primarily my HF radio. I've maneuvered it into operating on UHF VHF, although it's really not designed for that. But I'm using it right now as a backup just to see the waveform and make sure that my signal is getting received on Limark's Glen Oaks.
What would be your dream radio, AGR radio, if you would to suggest one? Or you would like to have one?
Thankfully, I don't know why, but I don't aspire to any other radio. The general usefulness, the utility of the 7100, like I said, doesn't have bells and whistles, but it's a heck of a radio. Maybe I'd like to have a 705 to play with. And I still love my 6700. It's about 8 years old, and the company Flex Radio is still selling it. It's the most feature-rich model that they sell. So it has not even gone out of production. So I'm kind of a happy camper where I am right now.
Thank you very much for that. The last question that I have is, would you mind if I have for the next week something more compact about extra low or very very low frequency rigs and technologies that would be sub 9 kilohertz and touch it.
Okay, I mean, it's a bit on the esoteric side. I don't think anyone out there listening tonight has plumbed the depth of that low a frequency.
Hey, think about it. Let me know. Thank you very much. And to you.
You're welcome, Wesley. While we were doing this tonight, a gentleman, Vic, sent me an email with a question. So I thought this would be as good a time as any to tell you what his question is, and maybe the people out there can roll it around and think about it and tell me what they think of it. His question, he just got his technician license, by the way. He's waiting to get his call sign, so that's great. His question is about sending packets through computer packets, I assume, through ham radio. and whether it's possible to create a pseudo-internet using multiple ham frequencies all on the same frequency, multiple ham radios all on the same frequency. And let me drop for a sec. There are things that are sort of like that. There is something called WinLink. WinLink is a radio-based interface to email. In other words, someone has a radio hooked up to a computer, and you can send text files over the RF and have it go into a mail server and be sent as email. So that's WinLink. There's also something called mesh networks. They're kind of local because they operate on the same 2400 megahertz that Wi-Fi and such do, and people basically repurpose Wi-Fi routers to perform this function. It produces a local mesh of 2.4 gigahertz stations that send packets back and forth across 2.4 gigahertz. And so that's a mesh network. The problems with the mesh network, very much like we were talking earlier with cellular phones, is that range is not a good thing. So what the mesh setups are designed to do are to operate with dense clusters of transmitter receivers and such to bounce the signals around. So in the same way that Internet Protocol, the packets go in a circuitous route and change depending upon the topology of the data stream, the mesh also will make all kinds of left and right turns to get the packets to the final location. So those are the only two that kind of sound like Vic's suggestion of whether or not there are somewhat pseudo-internets that are using amateur radio technology. If anyone else has any comments about what I mentioned or others that I failed to mention, please hit the push-to-talk button.
WB2KW3.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, I'm thinking about the some of the digital modes such as FT8, FT4, and JS8. They are basically sending data packets. I guess the advantage is their disadvantage. The disadvantage is the protocols are, I guess the transmission is wrapped very much in the protocol so that they're not general purpose data sending facilities. Their advantage is that since they know the data so well, they can really dig it out of the noise and can receive signals that are well below the noise level.
EC2GS, WB2KW3. Yeah, Joe Taylor and his colleagues have revolutionized low-signal transmissions. Primarily, it's a digital technology in the same sort of way that CW is digital, except it requires computational accessories, because the human brain can't do the error correction and other maneuvers that the software algorithms can. But I was thinking more in terms of packet-oriented and where the distribution is not point-to-point. And that's not the case with these data modes. They're simply a different mode of RF. It simply allows for a lower signal-to-noise ratio still being able to be read through it all. But it's a good point, Ken. There were a lot of packet, experimental packet radio back in 2000 and so. Unfortunately, I think the company that did the most work patented it all, so there was a heavy expense to it, which probably led to a degree of limitation of amateur radio operators really embracing it. But packet radio is still around. It's at the edges. You know, the same way that slow scan TV is around, but not a lot of people tend to do it for whatever reason. So there's also packet radio as something very similar to the internet. You know, the beauty of our hobby is we take the growing new technologies and we try and figure out if we can maneuver them and make our hobby better. So, you know, when integrated circuits came in and microprocessors came in and all this fun stuff, a lot of guys out there found ways of turning them into better radios for us. Is anyone else with any thoughts on the subject or any other technologies that I forgot to mention or I'm unaware of that are similar to, you know, amateur radio versions of the internet? Yes, Ken.
Okay, I guess the closest thing to that, you mentioned packet. However, there is a mode for the terminal node controllers on packet known as KISS mode, where essentially they are, from what I understand, it's not something that I have played with a lot, but essentially they are routing IP-type packets so that you can basically use them as a general purpose packet router.
Oh, okay. I have to look that up. I was vaguely aware there are multi generations of packet radio controllers. I think there's four classes. You know, the fourth was the best and the brightest, but also the most expensive. So, yeah, I'm vaguely aware of the packet radio technologies, but again, for whatever reason, it didn't really take off. Even things like mesh radio are more local phenomena. There are communities with a good density of amateur radio operators, and they've all kind of gotten together and put up ubiquity Wi-Fi routers on their roof with massive high-gain antennas, and they point them at the next guy who then points it at his at the next guy who points it at the next guy. It's a great deal of effort, but they've written a few articles on the subject that are rather fascinating. So once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night. We start at 8 o'clock, and we go on, hopefully, until about 11 o'clock. If anyone has any further comments on this particular subject or any of the other subjects that we were discussing earlier tonight, or if you have any new questions or topics or want to tell us about something you've discovered about amateur radio operating, some hardware, some software, some contests, some something or other, just feel free, hit that push-to-talk button.
Hey, Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, just to let you know, ACLR wrote on the chat room that she was mobile, so that's what happened, went out of range.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I was following the chat room. I sit here at the old shack. If anyone's interested, take a look at my call sign on QRZ, and you'll get a vague idea of what mission control looks like. I'm looking at my waveform going out. I'm looking at my waveform coming back on my Flex 6700. I'm following the Echolink, and I'm following the IRLP. We had a visitation from people down in, I believe, New Mexico or Arizona for a while. They came and they left, unfortunately. For some strange reason, yeah, okay. I'm following the chat room. So, fortunately, I was born with 17 eyes.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So when Kay brought up the topic, she reminded me of that unexplained incident or a couple of incidents, China and Mexico, CIA, all that nonsense with the directed energy or what have you. I thought I heard within the last maybe week or two another incident now in Washington, D.C. Did you hear anything of such?
Yes, indeed. And matter of fact, if you check out my link page, one of the links is the New York Times article on the subject. It got brought up again, and they're collecting more and more people with these really vague and confusing set of symptoms. There was some guy who started to get dizzy and nauseous, and their kid, I think, in the car started to bawl out for no reason, and when they got beyond a certain point, he felt a little bit better, and the little kid stopped crying. It's curious. The way that the article kind of is tilting is towards some kind of weaponry. Although they do cite people's opinion that this might be a lot of hysterical happenings. I don't know. I guess I'm a cynical person at heart. So I realize, although people have a different connotation of hysteria than doctors or psychiatrists have, it's nothing against them. But people are suggestive, and things happen. You feel different ways at different times, and sometimes you put two and two together and you come up with 22. But there is a link to a New York Times article on that exact subject that was published this week.
All right. On that link, will I hit a paywall, or is that a copy of the article, or what?
Unfortunately, the problem with linking to the New York Times is sometimes they let people see it and sometimes they don't. I think it's a function of the cookies that they leave behind. I think that their deal is that you can kind of go and read a couple of articles in a week or a month or something, but if you keep going back and they see your cookies, they lock you down for a while. So I unfortunately have no definitive way of going around them legally. So sometimes you hit a paywall, but sometimes you don't, is my understanding.
All right. Then I saw another recent YouTube on a preprint suggesting that the mRNA vaccine, which I already have, may reprogram the innate immune system. And I don't know if that was in a positive or a negative way. And I did see another link, which I didn't look at yet, on your site, which suggested that they found some condition where antibodies will not help or something like that. So any comments on those things?
Okay. All vaccines are going to modify your immune capability. That's primarily one of the purposes. It's to let your immune system make it easier to elicit a reaction, to recognize, to be more sensitive to, recognize and bring out a slew of weaponry, including not only antibodies, but killer lymphocytes, which are also very important in immunological attacks on infection. So it will change your immune status somewhat, but that's the point of the exercise. Otherwise, I don't really see. To me, I have not read a bit of evidence for anything negative about, you know, causing your immune system to produce autoimmune disorders. I mean, those are all kinds of a list of worst case scenarios that have not been suggested or proven by any of these vaccines yet. So it's things that people have talked about as a what if type of a thing without anything really being proved from it. So that's that part. Let me drop for a second. I'll get to the second thing. Now, when I first read that article that I put on my link page, it didn't quite sound like it what really was. It sounded, as you mentioned, about how some infections, you might have some disease that doesn't produce antibodies or that were resistant to antibodies. That's unfortunately, although the article is interesting, it's not about that. The article is actually about a genetic disorder in which some antibodies are not produced by the patient. And they end up with a lot of serious ailments because they simply can't fight it off with their immune system. In the particular article, you know, it's rather fascinating. They did a deep dive genetic survey of why this particular patient was getting all these infections, found the miscodon. And although we don't live in a world where you can just inject yourself with something that gets into each cell and changes your genetic code, and there'd be a lot of frightened people if there was, the solution that they chose for this particular patient was to irradiate his bone marrow and give him a white blood cell transplant for a brother of his. And that solved the problem so far. Fascinating article, but it's kind of not what you think it is from the title.
NYTH, yeah, clickbait. Although, yeah, well, that's interesting. Where do I see? Oh, they do that also with people. I don't know. That's the common technique, though, right? Knocking out the marrow and then putting a donor marrow in. All right. But I think the preprint, and well, they did have some, you know, evidence or data backing up what they were saying in a sense, but I guess, you know, it hasn't reached critical mass or been tested enough. But it sounds to me like the innate immune system, one where something novel comes in that your body that hasn't been pre-programmed for. That part of your immune system is changed in some effect. And I thought it might have been that it elicits more cytokines or something, but maybe I should find the YouTube and send it to you. But, okay, all interesting stuff. Back to that, NY2H.
Yeah, I would be interested, Lou, in taking a look at it. Again, there was a lot of chit-chat in general about whether there'll be autoimmune disorders that will go that will become there'll be more of them. You know, because we kind of go back to the flu vaccine in the 80s during the Guillain-Barré time, which was an autoimmune disorder where your body apparently decided it was going to attack your nerves, and you had ascending paralysis that in some people weakened them sort of like polio. In severe cases, it ascended all the way up to their diaphragm, and I had patients where I had to put them on respirators for a while. Thankfully, for the most part, in my experience, it was a short-term type of problem. It impacted their lives greatly, but the people that I were involved with, they all survived it. But Autoimmune disorders are one of those things that especially epidemiologists, virologists, vaccine specialists always worry about in the back of their head because, you know, you're diddling with part of the human body. You don't quite know whether they'll react reasonably or underreact or overreact.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder if that's why we didn't get the, you know, they're waiting for the full authorization. These vaccines are on emergency use authorization right now. And I suspect they're just waiting for the passage of time so they get a, you know, more longitudinal history on it. But it's been a home run. And, you know, I think it's all good.
Yeah, I agree with you. Again, I am by nature a somewhat cynical person, and so at the very beginning, I think I cautioned people that up until that point, the fastest people have been able to take an idea and turn it into a viable vaccine was more than 4 years. That was either measles or mumps. I always get the two mixed up in my head. So the fact that we were able to do this so quickly, and that most of the pathways that we've heard about have led to viable solutions. As far as I'm aware, the only company whose research basically ended in a dead end and they just gave up was Merck. All the other companies have brought their product out. In some, you know, to some degree or another, there's only been three that are approved in the United States, but probably as time goes on, there'll be a few more, although I doubt that it's going to be terribly used here because it'll be saturated with the market and so. But we were very, very fortunate. And the reason probably for the emergency approval, again, is because governments are conservative things by nature, and having you know about 3 or 4 months of research studies is pitifully small. And so, if this was not a serious illness, the FDA would not approve it. It's simply the 500,000 dead people from this virus that produced them to kind of jump over obstacles and approve it early. But people are going to monitor the results for years and years and years and see if there's any correlation with any problem. And, of course, there are dubious people out there who are telling people, matter of fact, that if you take the vaccine, it ranges from 5 years to 1 year, and ranges from, I think, something like half of them will die to nine-tenths of them will die. No proof, no studies to suggest it, but, you know, the sky is falling, cried Chicken Little.
Yes. The Internet is a wonderful thing, but now falsehoods spread very rapidly. So that's just something we're going to have to adjust to. All righty. Thank you, NY2H.
Okay, Doug. Thank you, Lou. Anyone else with any questions or topics or comments tonight? We got about 15 minutes here, so avail yourself of the opportunity. Okay, I think someone tried to transmit, but it was 101% noise.
B2BX,
so
am I getting through the noise?
Yes, Frank. Yes, you are.
Okay, I just tuned in, so I may have missed it. Have you talked about the 60-minute story on the Pentagon report regarding UFOs that's apparently in draft and going to come out shortly. Go ahead.
No, I have not. I think on my link page, I've linked more than a few articles about UFO investigations and people investigating why we're having UFO investigations, and all the people involved in the UFO investigations being kind of questionable in many, many different ways. So I've I haven't. Is this tonight on 60 Minutes, or was that an earlier one?
No, it was on this evening, so I would guess it would be available on demand tomorrow. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll take a look at it. I'm a kind of an inherently cynical guy. I've seen the old stuff that they released that is more has to do with perspective than anything else. I wasn't particularly as impressed as people who gawked at it. I think Tucker Carlson thinks that we're going to be visited by little green men any day now, judging from clips that I've seen of him interviewing people on the UFO. I have not seen anything that really struck me as remarkable. So I'll take a look and see what this new stuff is. 60 Minutes is kind of like that with these sensational topics. They kind of did the same thing with the secret weapon attacking our intelligence officers in China. I don't know. I don't know if they're really kind of hard up for viewers or whether they just kind of are taking a more news magazine pose these days. I don't know. UFOs strike me. I mean, I used to read Van Doniken and all those books when I was growing up. And I don't know. They didn't really pose anything serious to me.
You know, apparently Congress has funded a couple of presumably very serious military staff studies on this. And this is the latest one where they're asking for some Senate testimony, apparently, next month. For some reason, this is being pushed by Senator Marco. I guess he's looking for funding for the aerospace companies in Florida. Other than that, I'm not sure what his angle would be on this. So go ahead.
I'm not quite sure how that correlates. Because, you know, I mean, you're really going to get Congress to say, well, we have to protect our – I mean, they already got the Space Force someplace. We really have to protect ourselves against those aliens coming in and immigrating. So we have to double the rockets that we make. So I don't know. There's a guy who used to be Speaker of the House or leader – Majority Leader for the Democrats, Reid, who to this day is has UFOs on the brain. So I think that this was kind of his doing. He kind of set these things in motion many years ago, and they're still going on. And there are organizations filled with dubious kind of grifters who are promoting it as well. And they usually are repeatedly shuttled into Fox News and all these other places to give quotes about aliens.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Remember the old Air Force Blue Book story? You know, they kept records on this, and they finally released the information that was in there. It was all top secret for, like, you know, decades. And it all... It all basically proved that there was nothing there. You know, it was being from there and disappearing into a spaceship and then coming back. But not one person ever brought anything back. Not one person took an instrument off the table or was something that was sitting in the spaceship. There's just no proof of any of it, and that's what the final results were.